Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the latest Off the Ball Roadshow in association with Heineken Rugby Club. On stage tonight, the class of 2009, Michael Checker, Malcolm O'Kelly and Shane Jennings. Grand Slam winning British and Irish Lions Stephen Ferris. World Rugby Player of the Year winner Keith Wood. But first, give it up for Off the Ball's version of John Inverdale. He's our own Mr. Rugby. It's Joe Malloy.
Hello, Olympia. How are we all doing? It's great to have you here. Thanks so much. We love doing these nights, and they're great fun, and you're all very welcome. A big thanks to our friends at HeinekenRugbyClub.com. They make this all possible. They let us get the best guests, and we've got some doozies this evening. Leinster fans in the house? Yeah. I mean, Michael Checker, kind of legendary status, I would think. Yeah, he's on the way very shortly. Any Ulster fans? Great, yeah. Yeah. They're coming for you on Saturday. We've got some Munster fans, surely. Excellent. You're represented as well. So in due course, we're going to have Shane Jennings with us. Yeah. We're going to have Malcolm O'Kelly. Who doesn't love Big Mal? We're going to have Stephen Ferris, just for ye three here. But I need a co-host, don't I? I mean, I'm a little bit lonely this evening, so can you give it up for my beautiful assistant, Keith Wood, everyone?
Hello. How are you?
And can I say, you do look especially beautiful this evening.
I'm feeling very attractive. I'm wearing red socks for all the Munster fans who are there. I thought when I looked at the list originally, there were just too many Leinster people involved. Yeah. So I want to try and take them down a peg or two if I can.
Good. Today, well, you're in the right place. Let's get things moving. Our first guest, someone we've wanted to have on for ages, as you can imagine, but logistics not always the easiest. The only man to win a Heineken Cup and a Super Rugby title. 2015 World Rugby Coach of the Year. Brought Australia to a World Cup final. Has won a rugby championship. Brought European glory to Leinster. We're thrilled he's here. He's travelled a long way. He's just arrived today. We do appreciate it. Let's wake him back up and I think show the appreciation. Michael Checker, everyone! Have a seat.
Ready on me. Yeah.
Ooh. That's a welcome.
That's lovely, yeah.
That is a welcome.
I'll say that every day. Can we go back out and do it again? Do you have to do two takes here in the theatre?
Michael Checker, everyone.
Yeah, that's it.
You must feel the warmth when you come back to Dublin. Do you get back often?
Well, I saw the sun this morning. That was great when I got off the plane. No, I've been back a few times. Never for an extended period, just to come watch a game here or there or whatever. We've got such great memories of being here and huge part of our lives. First, you know, I suppose my kids were born here, or three of my four kids were born here, and I don't know, I just had such a great time here. Mm. I think sometimes I don't come back for long periods because you miss it, you know what I mean? So you just whip in, whip out, don't get too attached.
Arsene Wenger left London still not knowing his way around. You know, he just knew the way to the office. Did you get a feel for Dublin? Like, have you been here, for instance?
Definitely. I've been here. I've
Who did you see here?
I saw Faithless here.
Right.
No, you don't expect that, do you? Yeah. Yes. No, I didn't think you'd expect that. I personally didn't expect it either, you know what I mean? But it was good. It was good. I don't think I'd had the same stuff that they'd had on the night, but
for legal reasons, they had nothing on the night.
But I enjoyed it. It was good. And it's a great venue, for sure. Mm.
And Dublin generally, did you get out and about much or see much of the country, or were you too busy?
Ah, for sure. No, yeah. We loved it. You know, it was interesting because I came here first. I was single, right? So it was... Yeah, why are you laughing? What's the story there? You should laugh when you say I got married. Then that would be the issue. Who'd marry him, you know? So I had a couple of years as a single person here, and then I went back to Australia and just in a chance meeting met my wife, who... hopefully she's not watching. I've only ever had one. I want that assured to everybody, right? And she ended up coming living over here with me for a few years as well. So
how long did you know her when you convinced her to come over?
Well, it sort of went like this. It's quite an interesting story. I think I'd coached here for a year, and I was going back for the break in the summer.
So that's about 06.
The summer here that you guys have here, which goes for about a week. Yeah. So I went back to Australia, and at the time, Ireland were playing in New Zealand. So I thought I'd go give the lads a bit of moral support. Not they really cared if I was there or not. So when I went with a mate of mine, and we went and checked in on the airline, and she was working on the check-in. And he knew her. He was trying to get us upgraded. I said, let's just get Mick Dawson to pay for it. You know what I mean? He could have upgraded us. And we went economy and didn't get the upgrade. So I don't know why I got a number. But I was able to get her number. And then we had a date there. And we sort of long distance for a year. And then I said, come and live over here, which she did. And wow. C'est la vie, yeah.
Wow, great.
Is that part of the... your heart of being an Aussie is coming over here and loving it and enjoying it.
And I grew up playing rugby league, right? And so from very working class, you know, my parents are Lebanese immigrants to Australia. And I changed to play rugby because I genuinely thought I'd get a free trip overseas. Oh, I'm serious. And that's sort of what happened. I changed to play rugby, and within two or three years I was playing in France. You could play both seasons then, so 7 months, 5 months back in Australia, and just did that for 7 years. So I think Aussies, we love to... it's so far to come here. You love to... we've got this culture of travelling, you know, which is genuinely reciprocated by the Irish, who are now occupying my home suburb en masse.
It's our suburb now.
Yeah, I know. It was funny. Leo Cullen, who is now doing a great job coaching Leinster, came down when he was... yeah, give him a round of applause. Good on you. He came over to... you know, he said, look, can we come watch him? When I was at the Tars, you know, can I come and watch a bit and have a look and see what's going on? So he stayed down in the Coogee Bay Hotel in a sort of apartments there. He wasn't in the pub area, he was in the hotel area. And so I'd go pick him up in the morning to take him, and he'd walk down the street to get me. And blokes would do, hey, Leo, how you going, Leo? It was like a bloke was in his own suburb. He just turned up and he knew everyone on the street already because they're all from his hometown probably. But no, it's great. In fact, the Sydney Irish are the sort of lower team, the feeder team for Randwick, which is my home team.
Yeah.
So they've got a nice little crew going there, yeah.
You mentioned your parents there. It is amazing what can happen in the space of one generation. You know, so your father, Joseph, 1950, he would have been 20 years old in Lebanon, and Australia said, we need some workers, and he hopped on a flight, it seems.
That's it, yeah. 7 days back then it took to get to Australia on an aeroplane, if he could get there. That's serious. And he landed on Christmas Day in 1950. And, of course, they've got... I suppose there's a bit of that spirit, you know. Like, you leave home, you probably know you're never going to see your family again. It's not like you just can get the money and travel. And that real sort of, I suppose, risk-taking, but looking for a new adventure and experience. And he had one phone number, I think, you know. And the taxi driver, where are you from, you know, because he couldn't really speak English properly. He told him he was from Lebanon, so he dropped him in an area called Redfern, which is in the heart of the city, and it's, you know, it's hardcore, home of the South Sydney Rabbitohs, for anyone who follows rugby league, which then made us all follow that team. And my old man, who, you know, never laced up a footy boot in his life, was an absolute expert when we were playing growing up, you know. He'd come home, he'd tell you what you did wrong and what you did right, and which wasn't very much, and then, you know, what you did wrong again, and you shouldn't have belted that guy. And but he was good at taking us for a burger and something after training as well. So it is amazing, you know. It's,
and he did really well for himself, though, didn't he? Like, I mean, started off, I would presume, working in, I think, a factory and sewing factory, yep. but ran his own business ultimately, an amazing man.
Yeah, that's why you emigrate, to get a better, you know. Ireland's a very similar situation to the Lebanon in many ways, through a small country. There's been different versions of conflict, lots of emigrants, a big diaspora, and all looking for a better life and another experience so that they can get another level for their families going forward, which he certainly did for us, along with my mum.
Yeah, your mum from Lebanon as well. Did you feel, growing up, did you feel Australian or did you feel Lebanese or a nice mixture of the two?
Depends. At dinner time, I felt Lebanese for sure. Like, the tucker was excellent, you know. So, but it's an interesting, it's, you're Australian first because that's who you are, that's where you're brought up and that's where you love being. But you know you've got the other heritage. That the first time I went back to Lebanon as an adult, I really felt it strongly, you know. And I've been back there many times now. In fact, I have a great memory when I was here in Ireland. I went, unfortunately, one of my cousins went to Lebanon and he passed unexpectedly. And I went there to go to the funeral. And it was just before pre-season here in the second season. And the day I was supposed to leave was the day that Israel bombed the Lebanese country and then thus the airport as well. So I was sort of stuck. Mm. And a lot of the Westerners waited until they got evacuated maybe a month later and through Cyprus or whatever. But I said, dude, I've got to get back for pre-season. I can't, you know, wait. So I hired a driver, Alawite Syrian guy. And it was the most interesting 24 hours of my life, trying to get out of a border. We tried about four or five borders, crossings, couldn't get out. And through a lot of bribing and it was pretty scary at the time. Mm. And I remember the lads knew I was over there. So like guys like Dennis Hickey and Shane Horgan, etc., who were giving me a ring, seeing if I was coming back. Because we've already had four cages in 4 years. We can't lose another one the next year, not to the war. So it was in retrospect, it was really interesting. At the time, it was pretty scary, you know, because I was sitting in no man's land in the middle of Lebanon and Syria, and you could hear the fighter planes, because it's only a small country, Lebanon. By the time they bomb, they need the length of the country nearly to turn around. So you didn't know what was going on, and it was an interesting experience. You know, I was very happy to get back here when I got back here.
So there is the potential, well, they could drop one on us right now.
Who's that?
The planes going over. That must be crossing your mind.
No, I wouldn't do it now. What you mean is in back there, then. Back then. Mate, I didn't know what was going on.
I'm sure we're okay now.
Mate, I was thinking that Faithless had left some of their stuff behind.
No. No, I'm sure we're safe.
You're tripping already. I don't know what's going on here. But,
no, with that 24 hours mate, where you're there in the car, well, that must cross your mind.
If you've never been in that zone before, like if you've never been in a conflict zone before, you don't know what's going on. There's no contact with the outside. There was a period there where, must have been 200,000 people in this no man's land between the two borders, which I never even knew existed, and right on the most northern border of Lebanon and Syria. And it was, I think I can handle most situations. I can consider myself a tough guy. Like I was hiding in the corner, sucking my thumb. You know, there was shooting and people trying to get into the places where you're trying to get a visa, and you know, it was crazy. And then once you cross the border, it was like peace and calm, and just drive up to Damascus. This was before the conflict in Syria, and got to Damascus at about 1 a.m. and then just stayed in a cafe until about 4. And we got to the airport and they just took you, you know what I mean? They didn't care what ticket you had because it was a pretty full-scale evacuation at the time, yeah. And so then, I got back for pre-season. The boys didn't like it because I got them running up the hill pretty quickly. They wish I'd stayed there and got locked away. No, it was good.
You've been back since, haven't you?
Yeah.
And they are looking to play rugby, is that right?
Well, they are playing rugby down there. They've got a team in, I think, they're in Asia as part. I went there. Asia Rugby asked me to go there at the end of last year. And I was just amazed that boys and girls playing, you know, rugby in these schools that we went to, and their senior team actually won, I think, the fourth division, you know, of Asia. They beat with mainly homegrown players. Obviously, a lot of them have got different educations, but not bringing players from overseas. They had only three or four players who are Australian, Lebanese, or English Lebanese who went back and played in the team, and they were really You know, they'd made a movie about it and everything. So it was really great for me to see that, because I thought, you know, no one had an idea, you know. But I always remember the story about my cousin when he first came to Australia, and he would have been when he was about 13. So you just think about it like this. They've never seen these types of sports, contact sports, you know. So he gets put into school, the same school that I went to. This is before I went to that school. Obviously, he was well older than me. And he tells me the story of how he had to play rugby because he had to play at school. And he hadn't seen the game. He didn't know what was going on, couldn't speak English. He gets the ball. The guy crash tackles him. So the game goes on. He runs off the field to try to find a brick and starts chasing the guy. And I'll never forget whether my other relative, my uncle, we were all uncles and cousins, you know what I mean? Doesn't matter if you really are. He came from Brazil. He was on holidays, and this was in 88. And Randwick, my club, was playing the All Blacks. They were on tour. It was one of the few times they played a club team who were the champions the year before. And our small suburban ground was like packed to the rafters, stands, people on the hills trying to watch the game. So he had a ticket for the game. He left after 20 minutes. He said to my man, "This is barbaric. How can you let your son do this? You know what I mean? You're crazy. I'm not watching anymore. I'm out of here." And so it's totally foreign to them, but in the last World Cup, it was unreal, because it's where you get a great opportunity to, you know, go to different countries and, you know, be seen in different countries. And I saw a lot of press in, you know, Arabic newspapers, which I couldn't understand, obviously, but I saw my picture there, and then got to do a few interviews in Pidgin Arabic and Lebanese dialect that I can speak, just to think that people in that area are watching and enjoying rugby is a bit amazing for me, yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, that game against New Zealand in 88 that your relative left, is that the one where Wayne Shelford knocks you down and you get up and say, "Is that all you got?"
Oh, I don't know if I said that now. I was probably crying, you know, or something like that.
But it was... Eddie Jones says you're an excellent sledger.
Well, that was the... Yeah, I was good at it, yeah. He wasn't too bad himself, just quietly.
I wouldn't think so.
No, he was pretty handy, yeah.
You played for Australia under-21s?
Yeah.
And you were in the Institute of Sport there? You were progressing along?
Well, you were in
the mix?
It wasn't really that my style, that stuff. You know, I got invited. That was when it started becoming a bit more, you know...
Organised.
And I got invited to go Institute of Sport, and they had a rugby program, but I wasn't keen on that. I was more keen to come away and play overseas. Those things change your life. So I played six or seven years, France and Italy, and back in Australia. And then, so you can show how it changes your life. I'd had no tertiary education. And then when I went back to Australia, I had to get a job, right? Like, it was just 96, so the professionalism was just starting, but I thought, I've got to get a job, you know? So I looked in the job ads, and I saw a job for a fashion designer. Like, why are you laughing? I'm in a suit. And I understand why you're laughing, to be honest. And her name is Colette Dinigan, so she's a very well-known designer in Australia. And she wanted a business manager, and she wanted someone who spoke French and Italian, which I'd learnt playing in those two countries. And then I just lied about the rest. And she's not going to be watching the podcast, is she?
It's too late now.
So, and got the job. And then from there, stay there and then started my own business after that. So that's how it changes.
We'll come to that in a second. But is it true, the story, that you're in Bob Dwyer's office? This is before you head off for France and Italy. Mm-hmm. And, well, you tell the story. You're sort of nodding as if it is true, but it just seemed a bit too...
No, it wasn't Bob's office. It was a guy who... the guy who ran the club was a guy called Jeff Sales. So he was your classic club rugby legend, you know. He could skull a bottle of Captain Morgan's in one go, you know what I mean? And like, I just couldn't believe it when I got to rugby and these guys were there, and I started working at the club behind the bar, you know, when I first in the clubhouse. And he was a great rugby coach, but he wasn't a very organised runner of the club, right? So you go into his office and there was just a pile of papers on his desk, and the safe was wide open, amongst other things. And one day I went in there to put some stuff in his office, and I saw a little bit of paper saying, you know, number 8 wanted... or back rower, I think it said, "I want a back rower for France," or something like that. I saw it, and I just took the paper. and rang the guy. And the guy was, he was the representative of Remy Martin, you know, the alcohol brands in Australia. And I called him up and I said, oh, yeah, Jeff told me to ring you, you know what I mean? And then he was connected to Bob. Bob had put him in contact with Jeff, and then that's sort of how it started. And then I came, that was at Cast, when I started in Cast, yeah.
Wow. I mean, sorry, Keith, just wait. Was it not your dream to stay and play for Australia? If you're in the under-21s, I would have thought, God, it's obvious what my route in life here is, not playing for Castres in France.
Man, I didn't have any... Well, I didn't really know. I was just enjoying it. I think that there's... Even now, when the game's professional, enjoyment's everything, you know? And that fuels ambition. If you're not enjoying what you do, you can never get to where you want to go, you know? And yes, I often used as an excuse, well, they're not going to pick me or they're not going to do that. You know, I mean, I took that shortcut. And if I had that time again, maybe I would have stayed and fought harder to play for the national team because obviously it's a dream. I would say to the guys that I coach now, you know, I'm the person best placed to tell you how much of an honour it is to have that jersey because I never had one. And that's where you see it in retrospect. But when you're doing it, you're just enjoying it. And I still believe, yeah, I'm good enough. I can do that and make it as well. You know what I mean? As long as I go well when I'm back home.
Yeah.
Didn't happen, but that's the way it goes.
That was actually my question, Joe, so I spent too much time with you. But I was trying to look at it because for myself, when I look back on my career, my rugby career, I would think that I missed out on the fact of some of the fun. So I never really managed to go overseas or play overseas. And I had a few offers, and I never took them. I wanted to play for Ireland. But it was at the end of the career, it's serious all the way from the start to the finish. And you try and have a bit of fun, and you do have a bit of fun. But I never quite got myself to that point of where I was ever going to risk not playing for my country. So I've asked that of a couple of different guys who did it. I asked it of Andre Voss, who was captain of South Africa and left at 26 years of age. He said, well, I don't think they're going to pick me again. I could never quite understand why he wouldn't stay and fight for it. Was that a big issue for you? Or?
At the time, it wasn't. Look, now, I would have been one of the few kids from my background playing rugby in Australia at that time. You know what I mean? So I've always been a sort of outsider, I suppose, in rugby. Like, to say that I'm coaching Australia now, to me, I still have to pinch myself. You know what I mean? It's such an honour. And to be able to represent. And yes, I do think that not staying to fight was maybe not the greatest decision, but like I said, in retrospect, but I still wouldn't change anything.
Do you think it made you a better coach?
I don't know. I can't say that for sure.
Did anyone tell you not to go?
Not to go where?
To France.
No one was even talking to me. I don't know what was going on. I just...
Well, like, your dad, you know, seeing as he got into the rugby, did he not think, well, I guess it's hard, you know, he understands the joy of travel.
Well, my mum, she wouldn't come to the games. Every time she came to the game, I got sent off. So she wasn't allowed to come to any games, right?
Was there a connection between you getting sent off?
I don't know. But it was different back then too. And because you'd come back... Because I come back and play the season at home. So you play both seasons.
Yeah.
So I was still able to get picked, you know. I just had to play good enough in the time that I was there.
Yeah.
And, you know, man, I live, you know, like I've got a great opportunity to be involved in international rugby now. And the adrenaline... involved, even just being on the sidelines, outrageous.
You know? I guess life has kind of worked out. Something I should have asked 5 minutes ago when you brought it up. Did your dad ever get home to see his parents again after leaving at 20?
Not to see his parents. He went back, but not before his parents passed.
No. God, it's such a toll, isn't it?
Oh, look, that's a common story, you know what I mean? For better life for your kids, for yourself, and more for your kids. And that's what we'll continue to do always, you know. We'll always want to give a better life to the people that we bring into the world, whether at whatever level it is, whether it's even staying at home or going abroad or, you know, looking for better opportunities. That's what we do.
When you went to work for Colette Dinigan, did you suddenly think, God, I love fashion? Or was it very much a business thing and you had your languages, which you wouldn't have had if you hadn't travelled? Did you discover a love of fashion, or was it, you can make money in this?
Oh. But I don't think I really loved fashion. No.
Grow to love it.
Listen, when you're sitting backstage in the Paris runway show and it's all happening, it's pretty good. You're loving fashion. It's pretty good.
Right. So you enjoyed the work? It was exciting?
No, what I loved was the contradiction in terms of being able to work in that environment during the week and then go and bash people playing footy on the weekend.
Okay.
I think that, or get bashed, you know what I mean? I think that there's something about that contradiction, you know, and the guys would sledge me too about it, you know. The other teams would sledge me about, oh, yeah, you haven't got your lingerie on today, have you? You know what I mean? Like, so
there's an image no one needs.
No, exactly. But I really love that, right? Different worlds, you know. I've always had that sort of different worlds approach to footy.
And the decision to set up your own company, Live Fashion, is that the name of the company?
Yeah.
That was around 2000 you did that?
Mm-hmm.
So your own distribution company, I read it secured the rights to a jeans brand made famous by Victoria Beckham. No, that's true enough.
That was later on.
Later on, okay.
We started off in that sort of denim world, yeah. Right.
Incredibly successful. Like, you're now doing very well for yourself by all accounts, financially independent. Were you scared, you know, you set up your own business, between doing the accounts, taxes, regulations, moving into different countries, all of the stuff that would scare anyone setting up their own business?
Taxes? You have to pay, do you? Forgot about that. No, mate,
just go for it.
Yeah. Well, like, you've got a plan, obviously, and you've got to learn about stuff and make sure that you can instruct correctly. So you're using different, obviously using experts in different fields, but you can't just not have some knowledge of what you need to instruct them and how you need to instruct them so they can get the job done for you. Otherwise, they will get a job done and charge you for it, and you won't get anything from it. And it was great for me to learn about how to manage people and lead people and motivate and console. And sometimes, you know, yeah, I messed it up, how to recover from the mess ups. And also take calculated risks with my own money and with my business partner's money, and enjoy it as well. Like, I've still got friends from the first trade fairs. So the other day, or today when I got here, I walked down the road from where I'm staying to Costume. It's a store here in. Now, those girls I met at the first trade fair we ever did, I'm still friends today, you know what I mean, from whenever that was, in the mid, you know, early 2000s.
Mm.
And it was like never planned, like most things that we did, you know. And we were lucky because we were dealing with the Americans, who weren't that big on export at the time, right? So, yeah, we basically went across the country looking at what we might be able to get as the first brand to start us off. And we found this, the first one we went to, which was in New York, we finished in LA. Then I said, well, I'll go back over. I went back over to this place, just rocked up, knocked on the door and said, oh, we've got this business in Australia. And, you know, I may have, you know, embellished a little bit. And next thing you know, I was sitting with the designer and we ended up having a big night out on the drink in New York. And then the next day he gave me a whole sample range. I took it back home. Wow. And it sort of goes like there. And then, you know, told them we had a big setup in Europe. I may have embellished a little bit. I don't know.
lying is key.
No. It's embellishment. Okay. It's not lying. We planned to have a big setup in Europe, which we got in the end anyway. So, mate, it was good. It's great. It was a great education for me, and you know, it helped me a lot with coaching as well, how to deal with people, and because I was sort of I was just getting all that was all just moving when I started coaching.
Yeah, so.
Does that give you a sense of freedom, having the financial independence, a successful business that you can fall back on if it doesn't work out for you? You know, but does it give you a sense of freedom in making your decisions? that you're not doing it to see that, well, I might get sacked for this. I can actually make a stronger decision.
Yeah, of course. It's the ultimate freedom. You know, I'll never, you know, the times where you can make decisions and not compromise, because the minute, put it this way, the minute you got to, for me, the minute I'd have to start coaching to pay my mortgage would be the minute I wouldn't do it, because you'd have to compromise yourself too many times. Because not only as a coach, you don't just have to lead downwards, you've got to try and lead upwards as well, because there's people who you report to and answer to that you've got to try and guide in a certain direction as well, because you think it'll be the right thing for the team, not because you think you know it all. And that's not always an attractive thing for teams as well, to have someone like that.
Can you almost care about it more?
Definitely care about it more. Yeah. It would be very difficult for me to, for example, I haven't coached a lot of different teams, I suppose, but I would find it very hard to coach another team in the same country as a team in the same competition as a team I've coached already, because then it almost devalues all the words I've spent on that team that I was with first, you know. So that's always something I've believed in.
That's interesting, yeah. So you're moving in very different circles. Like, as ever with someone in the public eye, there's lots of rumours. Is it right that you met Beyonce and didn't recognise her?
She's not going to be watching this, is she?
Unlikely.
Through the fashion thing, right, you got to meet, through the designers, yeah, sure, you got to meet a lot of those people. I don't know. That's.
But like,
if you're not into the music thing, then you won't know who they are, will you?
The music thing.
Well,
you came to Faithless and you don't know Beyonce. I just.
Yeah, but it depends on your.
It's kind of hard to avoid, though, you know? It's like, I'm not into politics, who's Donald Trump? You just sort of know Beyonce.
Well, no, you don't. You know what I mean? So.
He loves Kylie only.
Derek Foley was here before. He was asking me some questions. You know the journalist guy?
Yeah.
He loves his music, right? So he was asking me about we had this thing about the poker face or whatever. It came up about, we used to use a little picture of a poker face, and I'd show it for the lads. It was supposed to be about an attitude thing, right? And he said to me, do you prefer Lady Gaga or the? I didn't even know Lady Gaga sung a song called Poker Face. So it's impossible for me to know if that thing. But he was totally convinced that I would know that, and I was not telling the truth. But if you don't run in those circles, you're never going to know, are you?
I mean, I don't run in those circles, but I know who Beyonce is. Look, we'll leave it there. I wanted to know if it was true or not. It's good to know it was true.
Yeah.
Was she offended? Probably not.
That same weekend, and that I end up having these American guys. I had dinner with with the guy from Queen, who's had the big curly hair, guitarist
Brian May,
yeah, and the guy from
Barack Obama.
No, I know him for sure. Famous Irish World Aid,
Bob Geldof.
Yes,
did you know him?
Not before then.
So hang on. Where were you during Live Aid?
Because I was sat next to him.
Where were you during Live Aid? What were you doing with your time?
I don't know, mate. I don't. Well, put it this way. When the 2003 World Cup was on in Australia, I was on the beach in Brazil. So I didn't see a game. Didn't see.
Yeah, I know, but I was asking about Live Aid.
I'm trying to get off the topic because I don't remember when it was.
1985, would it have been? 86?
84? I wasn't even born, I don't think. Yeah. I think I was born. I wasn't born then, I don't think. 84.
Any other famous encounters? There's a game in this.
It's interesting, you know, because you get to. I've got to meet a few different people who I wouldn't have expected I would ever get to meet, you know, so.
We want to talk Leinster. We're going to do that in 1 second. If we can skip ahead to round off this chat in so much as we can about your life and your career. Australia, as you said, I can only imagine what an honour it is to suddenly find yourself coaching the country. I mean, you kick off in the most unbelievable fashion. A World Cup final, you're World Rugby Coach of the Year. That must have been just an unbelievable rush. What are your big memories of that time?
I remember losing the final.
Really? Is that that's the lingering feeling?
Well, yeah. Because, don't get me wrong, love every game I ever am involved with the team and coaching Australia. It's like a dream, you know. So that's, I'm not taking anything of that for granted, never do. But, you know, when you see the other team holding up the trophy, because that's why you're doing it, that's the part that stays with you, I suppose, unfortunately. But there's a really good picture of that tournament of the team. Someone, it must have been the night before the final, I think they were having a team photo, and then one of the players took a selfie with everyone, all the players in the background, and you just see everyone smiling, laughing, enjoying, and that's a precursor to success. So maybe we didn't have as good a time as we needed to before the game because we didn't win, you know, but
16-3 down at half time, fought back to within 4 points with 10 minutes to go. Was it a shell shock dressing room at half time, World Cup final? We're 16-3 down.
No, mate, I've been in dressing rooms much further behind than that. Here a couple of times too, definitely. And no, never shell shocked. There's always a way to get it back. If one team can score that amount of points in one half, the other team can score that amount of points in the other. It's not. No. Just, I suppose, disappointed that we couldn't finish the run off, you know. And I think that as wonderful a tournament as it was for us and a lot of the memories, that's the end goal is to take the trophy home, you know.
There was stories from 2015 that the Aussie players were in the fan zones before some of the other games and everything like that. They seemed to have an awful lot of crack with it. Is that missing from an awful lot of the game?
For sure, there's not a lot of scope for it to happen anymore. We're so boxed in with different rules and regulations, and got to be here at this time, and everyone making everyone arrive here, and this bus has got to be there, and that guy's got to be there. You know, you got to wear this shirt and not that shirt in this place, and this shirt in that place. Like, it's crazy, you know. Like, at the end of the day, well. Yeah, look, we're gonna have a big year this year, big tournaments to play, etc. But we're also going to, I'm going to make sure that we relax and enjoy the ride. I suppose that's part of it. You know, you would know about it. You know, with the teams you've been involved with, just being relaxed doesn't mean you're down on intensity. It just means that you believe that when the game comes, you'll enjoy what you do, even when it's hard. Because when we talk about enjoyment, I'm not just talking about enjoying the easy things, I'm talking about enjoying the hard things as well. Yeah.
It's fascinating to get that insight, because I wasn't sure almost what your state of mind would be about rugby given what a tough year it's been for Australia. I'm sure people looking in from afar know how tough 2018 has been. 4 wins in 13. We saw lots of headlines, you know, worst run since 1958 for Australia, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember talking about you on the show in December, and there was this sense that Rugby Australia were going to review your position and were you going to survive? And it just seemed like again, from afar, thoroughly miserable kind of season. Has it been as miserable as it's looked?
From a results point of view, it wasn't pleasant, put it that way.
Yeah.
But, mate, if you're going to cry about it every time you get knocked down and sulk and look for an excuse somewhere else, well, then you're not going to go anywhere. You got to take the punches that you take, and you got to turn them into something else. And that's, finding... not the positive, more fighting back from adversity or from, you know, not having success. is really key if you want to be successful in anything. You know, in any one season, you could have a number of failures before you succeed, and that's what it is. You know?
Yeah, you had a brilliant quote before the England game in November just gone, and it just spoke of resilience, I thought, where you said, your family members can pass away, you get married, have a child, they break a leg. He said, we've gone into a world where we think everything has to be positive and got to be great, but melancholy and sadness are a part of human emotion. When it happens, you have to live it and then be optimistic about coming back.
Optimism is the key ingredient to resilience. Because when something bad happens, if you don't think that something good can happen the next day, well, then you'll just sulk.
Did your confidence get hit, your personal confidence in your ability as a coach get hit this year?
No, I get disappointed for the fans. Because that's my responsibility, to make sure that the kids wake up the next day. If we're on tour, they wake up in the morning and they see us, you know, with a good result, or that our fans who are stick by us no matter what, because, you know, we're the national team.
But you're confident. Get the joy. I mean, I get that's the motivation. Were you kind of scratching your head going, what am I, why am I not getting this right? Did you have those moments?
No, not why am I going to, what am I going to do to, not as, when I say that, I'm not questioning, more challenging myself as to what will be the thing that I do now to make the change.
Yeah.
And after the season, I had to spend a week really detailed, just myself, going through, removing the emotional connections and going through exactly what I needed to do to make sure that this season was bright, you know what I mean, and more enjoyable, and that we don't live the peaks and troughs, we just build and build and build till we get to where we want to go.
How difficult was it to part with Stephen Larkin then, who's been along with you for so long?
Yeah, tough. Well, we're friends, you know. Yeah. Maybe not anymore, I'm not sure, but
he was your attack. He was your attack coach.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I just, one thing's for sure, I don't blame anyone for anything. I always take responsibility when, you know, that's what you do as the head coach when things aren't going right for you, because you want to protect those people. And at the same time, need to do things to try to shake it up a little bit. So very tough.
Yeah.
I just think that sometimes you got to make those. It wasn't just him. There was about four or five others that we made changes to in the team. And I'm sure that when we go to the World Cup, the team will be in the right position and feeling the right way, because partly because of some of those changes of what's come in and what we've needed to change.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.